Welcome to the Peak Work Performance Summit, where we talk about scientifically proven ideas that make us smarter, healthier, and more productive. My name is Ron Friedman, and my guest today is the very prolific Tom Rapp. Tom has written many titles you're sure to have come across over the past decade, starting with the number one New York Times bestseller, How Full Is Your Bucket? The second book, StrengthFinder 2.0, was the top-selling book of 2013 and 2014 worldwide on Amazon. His most recent title is Are You Fully Charged? The Three Keys to Energizing Your Work and Life. You're about to hear some great insights from Tom, covering everything from how to get more sleep, to how to incorporate more movement into your workday, to how to be more present, both at work and at home. You'll also learn why you should never place a cell phone out on the table at a restaurant, the ideal ratio of carbs to protein every meal, and why walking is actually more energizing than sitting. Tom was traveling when we did this interview, and we recorded our discussion in audio. I began by asking him to describe the three keys he writes about in his new book for staying energized all day long. Here's what he had to say.
The most recent book from Are You Fully Charged, what I was really trying to get into with that book is that what are the most practical things that we all need to keep top of mind on a day-to-day basis in order to not only have a high sense of daily well-being for ourselves, but most importantly, to create well-being for other people. So instead of getting into, as I had in the past, what are all the things we need to think about over a lifetime or over a span of a year or over a span of a job or career, it's really looking at what are the keys to being energized within the day. And the first key is really about doing a little bit of meaningful work each day and being able to connect that meaningful work with how it has an impact on another person's life. The second key is about focusing on those little interactions. We have thousands every day, and trying to figure out how you can have at least 80% of your interactions be far more positive than negative, because you need at least that ratio to be positive versus negative in order to have really good days and kind of stay above water in terms of your daily well-being. And then the third key is to make sure that you have enough physical energy to be your best every day. And that starts with a lot of small choices about the way you eat, the way you move more throughout the day, and getting enough sleep to have a fresh start on the next day.
I think that's fascinating. And I think you've done a really great job here of taking what really amounts to decades of research and distilling it down into three important insights. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about how we can make those insights actionable. So for example, the first one was about meaning. How do we find more meaning in the work that we do?
You know, there, when we ask 10,000 people if they did a lot of meaningful work yesterday, just 20% said they felt like they did a lot of meaningful work in the past day. And my hunch is that most of us, a majority of people, are doing meaningful work that makes the difference for another person, but we're not connecting the dots in terms of being able to see that influence on a day-to-day basis. So relative to meaning, I think not only do we need to do something that moves things forward for another person, it could be as simple as if you're working in a call center, if someone dials in and you help to turn them around so they're nowhere near as frustrated or angry about your product or service, and they're maybe back to neutral, and that prevents them from having real bad interactions with family members that evening. Something that small makes a difference, but we've got to find little ways to acknowledge it and to connect our efforts with how it's making a difference each day.
Mm. I think that's such a great observation. You know, so many of us now work in jobs that require us to spend hours on end in front of a computer, and that's made it increasingly difficult to identify the value of our efforts. You know, in many jobs, and I can tell you because I've had some of them, it feels like you're essentially working in an email factory where on the commute home in the evening, you look back and you think, well, what did I really accomplish today? And your mind immediately goes to all the emails you sent. And that's just not very satisfying. So one suggestion you make involves taking the time to actively think about some of the people we've helped over the course of the day. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it can be as simple as if, and there are great new studies emerging on these topics where if you prepare food for other people as a job and you're in a kitchen, if you can see the customers who are eating the food you prepare, you make higher quality food, you make food that's more nutritious because you're connecting the dots there. And I mean, there's Adam Grant's kind of amazing work over the years about when people are dialing out and requesting funds for scholarships for college students, if they simply hear accounts, even in written text from real scholarship recipients, they raise more funds and they do a better job of it. And the, you know, maybe my favorite example from the Fully Charged book is an experiment where radiologists, who you'd think of all professions, radiologists who are reading scans of people who might have cancer, they could see they're doing pretty meaningful work. But when researchers, as a part of one experimental condition, appended a photo of the patient to the radiographic records, their diagnostic accuracy improved by 46% in one of these experiments. So we've just got to find a way to kind of see the person who we're serving at least once a day.
Right. It's something that we can do as individuals, but it's also an issue that's critical for managers and leaders to consider as well. So if you're looking to motivate your employees, finding ways of connecting them to their end user or their end customer and the people that they're serving on a regular basis can help motivate them and keep them energized.
You know, it's such a great thought about managers and leaders. Managers and leaders are the first ones who need to be thinking about how can they make sure that any person who works for them can see how their talents are being productively applied for customers or communities each day. And that might be one of the foundational principles of management or leadership, but yet it probably doesn't get talked about enough nowadays.
Great point. So how do we keep 80% of our interactions positive?
You know, it starts by one of the things I've learned across all these different areas, whether you're talking about meaning or keeping your interactions positive or even what you eat, is if you can kind of try and keep score throughout the day. I mean, none of us are going to have days where everything we eat is perfect. There's going to be some things that are kind of a net gain and some things that are net negative, just like our interactions. I've yet to meet someone who's gone through a day and had just purely positive interactions. And if I did, it'd probably freak me out a little bit. But what we can do is think about, you know, if we do have a negative interaction with someone, just keep in mind that it's going to take 3, 4, 5 positives just to get back to kind of a good operating baseline there and to use that heuristic throughout the day. A lot of that goes back to the very first book that I worked on more than a decade ago. It was called How Full Is Your Bucket? And it's about thinking about how each little interaction either fills someone's bucket or it takes from it. It's when you think about it, even when you pass someone on the street, those interactions usually carry a small positive or a small negative charge. They're usually not neutral or in between.
So if I've just had a really negative interaction with my manager who's, let's say, called me into his office and chewed me out for not delivering a good presentation, what do I do with the next couple of hours to get back on track?
Well, you know, I think the one way to look at it would be through the manager's lens, where it's the one thing that we do have control over is the way we respond or act to another person. So I've tried to focus more on the kind of outbound lens of that and saying that all my interactions with people, I've got to try and make sure I'm adding up enough positives for the other person. But if in that example, if you do have a manager that's kind of, let's say that's his style and that happens a lot, which is typical in the workplace today where people have pretty poor interactions with their managers, the one thing that you can do is to control your response. And you know, I've learned a lot about this over the years where no matter how difficult of an interaction you might have, whether it's with a stranger or your manager, you get to choose if you're going to let that cast a lens over your next interaction with a colleague when you walk out of your manager's office. And if you can at least try and turn that interaction positive for the other person, it takes the focus away from what your manager's done or maybe shouldn't have into something that's a little bit more positive for the other people around you.
So what you're saying here is that when we think about interactions, we're not limited to being on the receiving end. We also have the option of being instigators. So if you've had a negative interaction, one of the best things you can do is to try and make someone else happy on some level. Stop focusing on yourself and start focusing on others. Having a positive interaction, especially one that you initiated, can be energizing by making life feel more controllable.
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting for me. I've got a kind of a unique situation where I've been blind in my left eye and left side since I was about 16. And so whenever I'm in a crowded place or a coffee shop, I bump into people all the time and just know that's going to happen almost inevitably. And what I've learned from that over the years is that nowadays I look at it as kind of a unique psychological observation of what's going on in another person's life each time it happens, because my condition kind of stays constant. But what I can see is that Most of the time people are quick to be apologetic and diffuse the situation immediately. But in the rare cases where someone is real hostile and real angry about my bumping into them, that quickly tells me that there must be something very difficult going on in that person's life that they're frustrated about. And it's even more important for me to be as apologetic and diffuse the situation as quickly as possible. So when you look at things through that kind of a lens, especially in interactions with strangers, it helps to keep things from getting real personal or getting you wound up in a given day.
That's a very enlightened way of viewing that. And I mentioned to you before we got on the call that I used to work in politics, and in politics, people have very short tempers. And so if you've ever watched Veep, that's a fairly accurate representation of much of what politics is like. And when I was applying to graduate school, one of the questions I got was, how do you deal with people who have that sort of high level of ego in their interaction? They get quickly upset and they yell a lot. And my response was, if you view that anger rather than something wrong that you potentially did, but rather as a signal of fear on the side of the person who's expressing that anger, meaning that they're getting angry because they're afraid that they're going to fail at something that's critical to them, then that just gives you a completely different lens and really prevents you from taking it personally.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it as well.
Yeah. So there are many profound lines in your book, and here's one that really stood out for me. Being busy is often the antithesis of working on what matters most. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why that's the case.
Yeah, I think it's one of the greatest challenges, especially that's emerged for all of us in the last decade here, is that it's incredibly easy, and in some cases enjoyable, to just sit back and respond at everything that comes at you in a given day. Mm-hmm. So if you were to tell me that tomorrow I don't have any assignments other than just respond to all my incoming email, that sounds pretty easy and manageable and maybe even fun next to having to step back and really put together something new or initiate a new relationship or initiate a new conversation, which requires heavier lifting. And so I think the challenge that we face today is that it's so easy to spend not only a day, but a month or a year. I think people can easily spend a decade now primarily responding to other people's needs and not taking enough time to step back and initiate something that creates a lot of meaning and well-being for other people in the future. And, another piece that feeds into this is the average person today unlocks their smartphone about 115 times on average, at least on Android devices. It's probably higher on iPhone.
Wow.
And that doesn't count all the notifications you have coming on your desktop and your phone ringing and everything else. So my learning from a lot of this is the other big challenge we have today is just paying attention to the people that matter most. And when I think about that in my own personal life, I think we've got to challenge ourselves when I have interactions with my kids to have my smartphone completely out of reach so that I'm not only spending time with them, but truly paying attention. And I was really challenged by a study I read when I was working on this book that explained how if I sit down at a table with colleagues, let's say there are four people around a table, and I take my smartphone out of my pocket just because they're too big to put in your pocket sometimes now, mm-hmm. And I set it on the table. But even if that phone's powered off, there's nothing dinging, there's nothing vibrating, there are no lights flashing, that sends an implicit signal to the other people sitting around the room that I'm prioritizing that device, if anything rings or dings, ahead of them, and it degrades the quality of the conversation from everyone else's vantage point if I do that.
Yeah.
So I think we've got to be real conscious about the messages we're sending when we essentially tell each person we meet that, hey, this little brick that's in my pocket or device on my wrist takes priority over the conversation we're about to have. And go back and ideally, what I recommend to people on this, imagine that you're in a conversation with someone at work who you really care about and you're trying to help them think about their career, or you're having a really meaningful conversation with a loved one, either one of those scenarios, and then shut off all your notifications that pop up on a moment-by-moment basis and go back in and turn on the things that really deserve and need to get through to you in emergency. So you can set it up on, I think, any phone now where if someone in your favorites or a family member calls twice in a row, it's an emergency that breaks through, fine. but 98% of the things that show up on your lock screen that cause you to open your phone and get distracted, like whether two celebrities broke up, which you get breaking news alerts for nowadays, that kind of stuff, frankly, doesn't need to break your concentration when you're with someone you care about.
Great tip. So make the phone work for you instead of letting the technology dictate where you direct your attention.
Precisely.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned getting into this reactive mindset, which we often do at work. And it's almost like, you know, for many of us, that's the first thing that we do. We've been trained to do it where we check our voicemail or we check our, you jump on email. First thing we do, we sit down at our desks in the morning. And, you know, in many cases, it's because we want to be responsive to our colleagues. And we feel like if we don't do that, then we're not doing our job correctly. But in fact, when we put ourselves in that reactive mindset first thing in the morning, we make it more difficult for us to do some of those important things that are going to energize us and going to have meaning for our careers.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about that in some of your work as well, that it's a trap that, you know, I've been in this mode myself personally for many years, where whenever someone asked me how I was doing over the past decade, my most common response was probably, oh, I'm crazy busy. I'm busy, but good. But the more I studied this and read a lot of good thinking on the topic, I've kind of forced myself to stop and pause whenever I'm asked that question. I can either tell people that I'm doing a poor job of prioritizing my own time, which is what being busy all the time essentially is, or I can tell people that things are going well and I've kind of mapped out my time in the right way. And I think it's an important reflection for a lot of us to step back and think about, because if we spend all of our time just kind of spinning and being busy, we don't take that time, as you mentioned, maybe early on in the day, where I've created a lot of little rules and shortcuts for myself where I can't respond to an email in the morning until I get some activity or do have a little exercise in the morning just to get going. And I mean, maybe I read things and check in, but I won't respond to anything until I force myself to get some activity. And I know a lot of other people who do that with writing, where they write first thing in the day for a couple hours before they start responding and get into that mode. So we've got to find little shortcuts or carve out time for the things that matter most before we get pulled into that busyness trap.
Hmm. So you mentioned changing the settings on your phone so that phone calls that aren't vital don't interrupt you. You mentioned looking at your email but not responding until you've gotten some work done. Are there any other tips you can share on how to avoid the busyness trap?
Yeah, I think if you can always have one, two, three projects on your radar that you're contributing some time to each day that you feel like are really moving the ball forward for other people in the future, mm-hmm. that allows you to chip away, whether it's a writing project, if you're in a business development role and it's reaching out to one new person, building one new relationship for your organization so you can potentially have a new customer down the road each day, mm-hmm. and trying to spend, I mean, even an hour a day where you're contributing to something that will continue to grow instead of just kind of deflecting everything coming at you. It's kind of the offense versus defense. When I've interviewed leaders who have really done things that made a difference, they almost always point back to time spent initiating instead of just responding to employees' needs and demands on a given day like that.
That's a really interesting analogy, offense versus defense. I think that's a really fascinating way to think about it. So really, at the end of the day, you could think about what percentage of my time was spent mm-hmm. on offense, what percentage of my time was spent on defense. And I think you'd probably find a very, very strong correlation with amount spent on offense and feeling like you've had a good day.
And even 10, yeah, I hadn't really thought about it that way before, but even 10% of your time in offensive mode could make quite a difference, because I bet most people don't even get 10-20% of time when they're really on offense in terms of creating new things for the future.
I think we just come up with the title of your next book.
There you go.
So let's talk about your previous book, Eat, Move, and Sleep. In that book, you spent a lot of time talking about a topic that I think is very fascinating, which is how food affects our energy level and our well-being over the course of the day. Let's talk a little bit about food. How does food influence the way that we work?
You know, there's so much talk out there about food relative to obesity and diabetes and cancer and all these things in the long run. And frankly, I don't think that those long-term motivators work very well So that's what got me into this topic and thinking about this in a lot more depth. And I'm really amazed by the way food in particular has pretty direct implications for our energy levels within a day. And when you can start to connect it with your energy levels within a day, it makes those choices a lot easier. I talk in Eat, Move, Sleep about how a lot of my research on health started because I was diagnosed with a real rare disorder when I was 16 that essentially shuts off the body's most powerful tumor suppressor. So when I was 16, I lost an eye to cancer. And over the last few decades, I've had cancer and currently do in my kidneys and my pancreas, my spine. So I have annual extreme health challenges where I go in every year and kind of do all these scans and get a new lease on life. But that, frankly, over the years, wasn't a great motivator to make better dietary choices. What was a much better motivator was when I started to connect the foods I'd eat early in the morning or at noon with my energy levels later on in the day. And I realized that if I have a breakfast filled with sugars and carbohydrates and so forth, I'm nowhere near as sharp at an event middle of the day or in the afternoon when I'm working. And I think the thing that really got into my head as I was working on this book, I normally eat pretty well, but when I was working on the book, my mom invited my kids and I and my wife to go to brunch at a trendy new restaurant in downtown DC near where we live. And I went there and there were only three or four items on the menu. And so I thought I was being good by not getting the chocolate covered donuts that looked great to me. And I got the eggs Benedict, which comes out covered in a hollandaise sauce. And there's some fried potatoes on the side. And then it comes with a biscuit and gravy as well. And so I eat all that. And I also had some of my wife's chocolate covered donuts. And then what I realized was that was, I don't have that much willpower. So I kind of gave in, but that afternoon about 2 or 3 o'clock, my daughter who was 5 at the time is kind of pulling on my arm and I'm wiped out laying down on the couch. And I didn't have enough energy to be a good dad or take my kids to the park that afternoon because of my dietary choices. And it kind of dawned on me then and reading some research about how scientists have found that people do have these kind of high fat hangovers and they do feel poorer in the day when you eat bloating breakfasts and eat too much sugar early in the morning and so forth, that the foods we eat can kind of be fuel for the energy we need late in the afternoon and the evening, or they can start a downward spiral where you're less likely to get activity if you eat an unhealthy breakfast. And what you eat during the day also dramatically influences your ability to get a good night's sleep as well. So eating is just a good place to start, not only so you can have the energy today, but so you get a head start on the next day.
Yeah, just great stuff. I mean, I have to tell you, I kind of had a similar insight myself, which is that for a long time, I would eat a lot of fast food for lunch, not because I particularly like McDonald's or any particular fast food, but because it just felt really efficient. It was something that I could just jump in my car, get some food, be back at my desk 15 minutes later, back at work. And then when I started exploring some of the research that you mentioned and looking at my own experience over the course of the day, and really what brought this to light for me is I like to play racquetball at about 5:30 every day. And what I noticed is on days when I have fast food, I would essentially concede 4 to 5 points in my singles matches. And I, you know, it's not something that I was necessarily looking for. It's just something I noticed. And then when I started making that connection between the work that I do following a lunch of fast food versus having, you know, a salad or something that's a little bit better for me, I would just get a lot more done. How do you get yourself to eat more healthy foods over the course of the day, particularly when you're at the office? And, you know, a lot of times it either requires more money or requires planning ahead from the night before or requires you having an hour to go to a restaurant where you can actually get something that's healthy to eat. What are some recommendations you have along the lines of training yourself to eat a better lunch?
Yeah, you know, I've found that a lot of this starts with building healthier defaults into your daily routine. So, and there's some of the best research on all this has been conducted by Brian Wansink, who's kind of the world's leading expert on behavioral health. And if you, for example, if you have a healthy breakfast, so every morning I kind of just, it's boring, but have the same default breakfast that's easy to put together, that if I'm at home, I have a lot of green vegetables and some berries and I put them all together in a shake with unsweetened coconut milk or something along those lines and get a lot of nutrients real early in the day. If I'm on the road, I always have an egg white omelet filled with as many vegetables as I can find at a given hotel and make that first meal pretty simple and ensure it gets me off to a good start. And then throughout the other thing that's big is even mid-morning or throughout the day to build snacks in that are really easy and as convenient as fast food. So if I'm going through airports and I know it's going to be tough to get something that might be healthy on an airplane or when I'm bouncing from place to place and don't know what foods might be served, I always carry a couple bags of kind of portable mixed nuts with me that I know I can use in a pinch if there are no healthy options at lunch at a place where I am, or if I just need it for a snack while I'm on the road. And when I am at home, I have pre-cut carrots and apples and all kinds of things sitting around that are the first things I see in my refrigerator. And I've either gotten rid of or hidden all of the unhealthy options so they're not there and I'm not tempted in a weaker moment mid-afternoon or later on in the day. And so it's a lot like the activity element of things where, you know, as you mentioned, we've essentially built so much convenience around unhealthy choices that we need to go back and engineer healthy choices into our daily routine and make that just as easy as the unhealthy choices, just like we need to go back and bring back and restore some of the activity into our routine that we've engineered out on a day-to-day basis.
You mentioned starting your day in a healthy way, and it sounds like you're getting some protein with every meal. One suggestion you make in your book is that instead of worrying about calories, it's far more important for us to focus on the ratio of carbs to proteins. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I'm someone who's has been pretty careful, is more because of my research background, at just reading nutritional content and labels extensively over the last decades for the sake of my own health. And I've known for years that as someone who's just battling cancer every day, that I need to minimize the amount of sugars that I'm putting in my body first and foremost. And that looking at, I mean, carbohydrates are essentially refined carbohydrates, I should say, to be specific, are one, I mean, they essentially get converted to sugar when they hit the bloodstream. So those are two of the things that I've watched out for. And what I've learned in just studying this myself for a few decades is that calories, which a lot of people focus on, are almost more of a measure of volume or quantity or consumption, and that they don't speak very well to the quality of what goes into our mouths through a given meal or a given food. And what's maybe the best available metric, at least on nutritional labels in developed countries that I've found, is to look at the ratio of protein to carbohydrates. And if you look at a bag of chips, for example, there might be 20 carbs for every 1 gram of protein. And to try and find things that are, I mean, ideally 1-to-1, and at a minimum, somewhere between 2-to-1 and 5-to-1 of carbs to protein, so that over time throughout the day, you're getting enough of the protein that your mind and body needs, but not as much of the carbohydrates and sugars, where sugars is another important element to look at there, where, I mean, honestly, there's no real dietary need from everything I've read for additional sugars or added sugars throughout the day. So while the sugars that you get from eating a whole apple, the way they're digested aren't that bad for you. Anything that has a lot of added sugar into a given product or packaging or food is another huge problem in addition to the ratio of carbs to proteins.
Why do I want to avoid sugars?
Well, I mean, beyond natural sugars, the added sugars that we get in our diet are probably the leading cause of diabetes, obesity, and sugars are kind of an interesting one because it does give you a near-term hit or a near-term burst of energy, but we've got to think about what it does over the next 3 hours, the next 5 hours. And that's been one of the most important findings for me, is that if we can connect how something makes us feel later on in the day and realize that sure, sugar gives you that quick 90-second hit, but 90 minutes later, it's not as helpful, that makes it easier to also connect to the longer term goals, which we all know that, I mean, there are as many dietary opinions as there are citizens of the United States, I'm convinced, after writing the Eat, Move, Sleep book. Everybody's got their own positions on diets. And there've been so many big trends over the years, but there are a few things that I've seen that are common across almost every diet or expert recommendation that I've read. One is that there are very few people, if any, that need to add more sugar to their diet today. The other one is that there's nobody out there telling you that you need to eat fewer green leafy vegetables or green and red vegetables in particular. And there's nobody out there telling you that you need more fried foods or foods with kind of fatty fried foods and content in particular. And so I think what we all can do is draw from some of those common learnings and say, how do we build more greens into our diet? How do we build more of the, let's say, the healthier fruits? So you have apples and blueberries and strawberries, any types of berries in that general range, the dark reds and blues and greens into our diets, and load up on those things first before we eat some of the more tempting things that should be on the periphery of our diet.
So to bring this down to a practical level, if I'm at a business lunch and it's a set menu and the dessert is a creme brulee, if I eat that creme brulee, am I going to be more tired 90 minutes from now than if I decided to pass?
Yes. Now, if it's late in the day and you're going to bed, it's not as relevant as what you're eating early on in the day. But what I've found from all of these studies is that if you minimize the amount of sugars and fried foods and you get more protein relative to carbohydrates early on in the day in your first few meals, not only will you feel better later on, but it also makes it easier to resist temptation because you're essentially trying to store up willpower by making better automatic decisions early on in the day so that you have a little bit more willpower left. So at dessert, at dinner, you can just pass altogether on the creme brulee.
Right. So not having a choice is better than making the right choice.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting to me. It changes so much based on where you are geographically and by culture. But I spent a week in California just last week, and, you know, it's kind of become the new marshmallow test to pass on the breadbasket nowadays. So I think people are starting to realize that, I mean, there are things at meals you just don't need. So the breadbasket would be one. I mean, even having desserts, especially associated with lunch, and I would say with dinner as well, to just realize that you're a lot better off passing on some of those things. Because, I mean, while it's okay to splurge and have a dessert maybe on your birthday or at a special holiday, I mean, every day is somebody's birthday, and we have several events every week, from friends events to workplace events, that if you think that it's a good idea to have dessert at every one of those, that does work against you quite a bit over time from a short-term and a long-term health standpoint.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the move part of eat, move, sleep. You know, a lot of people assume that sitting down allows them to conserve energy, but you argue that in some cases, it's just the opposite. Sitting can actually be more exhausting to our bodies than moving around. How can that be?
You know, it's a really good point you bring up about how what's built into some of the expectation is that you sit to conserve energy. And I'm sure that was the reasoning many, many years ago behind the evolution of how we've kind of become tethered to chairs nowadays in our culture. And so there was probably good intent there when you go way back to it. But what's happened is that, you know, simply, I don't think it's an argument of sitting versus standing. What's happened, because just standing all day would be about as exhausting as sitting all day, probably. But the problem is we've reduced almost all of the variance out of our routine in terms of moving more, and both sitting and standing and walking or pedaling or whatever you need to do, so that for whether you're talking about the benefits for our physical health and our body or just for the mental activity, we need breaks at least one every hour, ideally two every hour, every 20 minutes, where you're getting up just to stretch and stand or walk to get a cup of coffee or have a quick conversation, because there are real benefits for our cognitive ability and our thinking throughout the day when we're able to do that. And what I'm concerned by when I look at this over the last 25 years in particular is that there's been so much messaging about the need to have 30 or 60 minutes of intense cardiovascular activity or real exercise 5 or 6 days a week from things like national recommendations, that's so intimidating to 80 or 90% of us, at least here in America, that it keeps us from doing a lot of little things throughout the day, which I would argue might be even more important, because even if you get that 30 minutes of exercise 5 days a week, it does not counteract 8 or 10 hours of sitting for a full day between commuting and sitting in a desk chair or watching television when you get home. And those things add up so quickly, and I would argue are a bigger problem than lack of exercise in our culture today. So we've just got to find little ways to break it up. And it can start with setting a timer so you get up every 20 or 30 minutes, or buying one of these. I just found a band that's $14 you can wear that vibrates every 20 or 30 minutes if you hadn't had any activity at all. So it's not even that difficult or cost prohibitive to do nowadays with all the technology we have to make sure that we're moving around more. And then ideally you find a way where you can get work done while you're both sitting and standing, or better yet, walking throughout the day, which is, you know, I've been walking while working in my office for over 2 years now, and it is remarkable how much more energy I have at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when I've spent a day on my walking desk instead of sitting on airplanes or in meetings all day.
Huh. So you have a walking desk. It sounds like you have a standing desk as well.
Yeah, I actually, you know, it's interesting. I originally had a treadmill in the basement that never got used like many others. And I put a 2x4, a board from Home Depot over it and a keyboard, and thought I'd test this out and see if it was practical. And it took a few weeks of getting used to. But after about a month, if I would just walk slowly, 1.5 to 2 miles an hour, I mapped all this out in a spreadsheet with how many pages I wrote per day and how many steps I took per day. And I found that I was writing and editing about 30% more on days when I was walking at a slow pace throughout the day. So that's become my new default, where anytime I'm in my office, I spend the vast majority of the day walking on a treadmill at a slow pace. And when I first started, I had a sit and stand desk right next to it that when I needed a break, I would use that. But I found that I still got pulled into the sitting way too much. And so I eventually just kicked the chair out of my room. And now when I'm doing things that require more kind of dexterity, or I'm on a conversation where I don't want the treadmill in the background, I use a seated pedal desk so I don't have the alternative of a traditional chair.
Huh. Standing right now?
Yes. I've been standing and rotate with sitting on a desk that has pedals, but no, it doesn't have any electrical element to it, so you can't hear it in the background.
That's fascinating. So now, what do you do if you work in an office where, you know, having a treadmill and a bike desk, these aren't options? Do you set an alarm to remind you to take a 20-minute walk every couple hours?
I think you can default to the 20-minute, or there are a couple other things where anytime you're on a conference call, whether you use a wireless headset or one with a longer cord, stand up. I used to do this all the time when I worked in a more traditional office setting where I would just walk in little circles around my tiny workspace. And at first, people might have thought I was crazy, but eventually I figured out what I was doing. And the other little thing that you can do is find a way to, I mean, the other thing I did is kind of an interim step is to put, I have way too many extra books lying around here, but I'd stack my laptop up on books and rotate between that and the seated position. So I think we've got to find creative ways to do that. I saw that Ron Lieber, who's got a great book about the opposite of spoiled, he, every time he goes, finds new creative ways to make a standing desk in his hotel rooms, and had been posting pictures of that on Twitter, which I've been admiring that and trying to do it myself when I go around to hotels to find the right surface or to stack things on an ironing board so it works out right.
Really interesting. So really, you know, the idea is to just break out of this old mentality of if your office isn't providing you with the right desk, then, you know, you're screwed. Rather, try to be creative, look for some new ways of incorporating activity into the way that you work.
Yeah, and you know, it's important to know that it's not just about the workstation or space that you're at, where we've all kind of been guilty of essentially finding miraculous ways to engineer activity out of our lives. So we click a button and someone from Amazon shows up here in DC later the same day with whatever you want on your doorstep. And we drive around parking lots for 10 minutes so we don't have to walk an extra 50 steps. And, you know, in the workplace, I've had so many people say, oh, I need a printer in my office so I don't have to walk all the way down the hallway. And we've got to find ways to just flip that thinking around and say, what are all the little excuses throughout the day where we could add 50 steps, we could add 100 steps? Because it's amazing once you start to measure that with any simple device or pedometer, how easy it is to get to 10,000 steps if you just build small things in throughout the day, even if you don't have a walking desk or you don't have a large space to walk around when you're getting your work done.
Great stuff. Let's turn to sleep. So this is the last of the three topics. Over the last few years, scientists have uncovered some compelling evidence about all the ways that sleep impacts our performance during the workday. Take us through some of it. Why do we need sleep, and how do we get more of it?
Yeah, you know, the research emerging on sleep, as you mentioned, is just remarkable. Where, I mean, we're now seeing that sleep has a profound influence on incidence and growth of cancer. It affects heart disease. It obviously affects obesity and diabetes, and very strong associations over time. But what's been maybe most interesting to me is that all this more near-term research has emerged on sleep, showing that how it affects our energy and productivity throughout the day. So I'd always grown up in this kind of in a hardworking Midwest culture where I would never admit that I needed a whole 8 hours of sleep. And everyone talked about only needing 4 or 5 hours as kind of a badge of honor. But it turns out that if someone misses kind of 4 hours below their baseline of sleep, that's the equivalent from the standpoint of cognitive impairment of having a six pack of beer in your system. And so we can't have people, 3 or 4 people in a meeting sitting around in the middle of the afternoon that have the equivalent of that type of impairment. And I certainly don't want the pilot on my plane tomorrow to have that kind of impairment in his or her system. And we don't want teachers or doctors who are surgeons in particular with having that kind of impairment at any time of the day. So what I think we need to go back and kind of think about sleep as the fuel for performance. And in the documentary that we've been working on around these topics, we interviewed the Army Surgeon General, and she talks about the way she's on this incredible mission to build the sleep initiative into the Army, because she describes the way soldiers need sleep and it's ammunition for their brain when they're in the battlefield. Mm-hmm. And we've got to start to think of that way, where when you need to be at your best and you need to perform and you need to be a good parent or a good doctor or teacher, whatever you do, you need to make sure you get a good 7 or 8 hours in order to be your best the next day.
How do you get 8 hours of sleep? Are there some tips you can share around how you wind down at the end of each day?
You know, there are a lot of little things, just little tips and tricks that make a difference from a sleep standpoint. So sleeping in a room, whether I'm at home or on the road, that's a few degrees cooler in the evening than what you're used to during the day. So cranking the temperature down helps a little bit. Avoiding all electronics and anything with kind of an LED or a bright backlight in the last hour before sleep makes a profound difference, both because you're not worrying about that email you got 10 minutes before bed psychologically, and just the actual light suppresses the hormone melatonin that you want to kick in at that time as well. So keeping the devices away for at least an hour before bedtime. And then, I mean, for someone like me who moves around on the road and lives in a city, doing something as simple as using a white noise app that you keep on throughout the night, that creates a constant so that little things that really shouldn't wake you up don't get you out of bed. So that's kind of the tactical stuff. At a more general level, as a family, we have been really careful with little kids to make sure that sleep's a family value. And we talk all the time about the value of a good night's sleep and I ask my kids, it's probably the first question, most common question I ask them in the morning is, did you get a good night's sleep? And we don't treat going to sleep as a punishment if kids get in trouble. They don't have to go lay down or go sleep if they get in trouble, because that sends a very different message about how we value sleep. And, you know, workplaces need to do this too, where there are open conversations with managers and employees about how their schedules can work better so they have time to get a good night's sleep, because it really does matter for the sake of the organization's clients and the quality of their products. And so I think having some of those discussions casts sleep in a very different light. And then, you know, the other thing more that's personal for me as someone who travels quite a bit when I have books coming out and so forth is that sometimes you need to budget. I know when I'm on the road, I might need to budget a 10-hour window in order to get 8 good hours of sleep and to be effective the next day. And you've got to think about it in kind of that regard, if it's the first priority, not the first expense that you cut, essentially.
That's a great point. If you're working in the modern workplace, you need to view yourself as a mental athlete and really treat yourself as such. And preparation for a good day at work starts the night before with a good night of sleep. One of the things that I've noticed that really helps is, instead of assuming that 8 hours in bed is going to be enough, give yourself a wider window to account for all the time it takes to actually fall asleep at night, so that you have those 8 hours of uninterrupted rest.
Yeah, that's something that I think sometimes people take for granted, where, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the last months with some people who I admire a lot that have been real high achievers, and they kind of treat the hours in a day as if they're home by 11 o'clock, they know they can schedule their next meeting at 7 a.m. because on a clock, that's 8 hours that they should theoretically be able to get in sleep. But you're not thinking about that. Just budgeting that window doesn't mean you'll actually get a full 8 hours there. So I think we've got to help the people that we care about too, to structure their schedules so that they really do have a little buffer there too, and have a chance to get sound sleep on most nights.
Right. And I, you know, from a managerial standpoint, again, you know, it involves highlighting that as a value. And it also can mean something as little as programming the emails that you write at 11 o'clock at night to arrive in the in your employee's inbox the following morning, so that they don't feel compelled to respond. And then, you know, that kind of snowballing into an exchange that lasts all through the night.
Yeah, you know, it's such a great point that this comes back to an important conversation between leaders and managers with their employees about how do we ensure you have the energy you need for performance and well-being in your job. Mm-hmm. And that it's not just about kind of the low-hanging health costs and so forth. It takes the conversation in a different direction, because that is a much more proactive conversation that managers can have with employees and help them to understand that they do want them to show up the next day and to be their best in some of the things that they're doing.
That's right. Well, Tom Rath, this has been incredibly energizing for me. I hope it has been for you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it and had a good time.